Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we really get into the surprising complexities behind things you thought were simple. Think about, the clink of ice in a glass, that nice amber glow of a good whiskey, maybe adding a splash or something. It's a familiar picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Relaxing.
Uh-oh.
Maybe celebrating. But behind that simple moment, there's often this whole intricate world. Business, history, going back centuries, intense competition that you probably don't even see. Today, we're pulling back that curtain. We're doing a deep dive into the Brown-Forman Corporation. Now, you might not know the name Brown-Forman itself. It's not usually on the bottle, but trust me, you know their brands. We're talking about the company that makes Jack Daniel's and the really smooth Woodford Reserve or the classic Old Forester. And this isn't just, another spirits company. They're pretty unique. Family-controlled global leader, been around for over 150 years, navigated everything from market crashes to prohibition. So our mission today is to give you the shortcut. The key insights you need to really understand this powerhouse. We'll dig into their big strengths, the things that have kept them going, but also dissect the challenges they're facing right now. And they are facing some big ones. And we'll pinpoint what you should actually be watching for going forward. What makes them different? What are the pressures? And how are they trying to adapt? And here's where it gets really interesting. You've got this company with this amazing history, known for quality, consistently delivering for shareholders for decades. But right now, they're seeing sales drop significantly in their most important markets. Their own leadership sounds pretty cautious. And maybe the biggest thing, they're doing this massive internal overhaul of how they distribute in the U.S. That could change everything for them. So why dive in now? Well, because it feels like a real turning point. A mix of serious challenges and maybe huge potential change. Let's get into it.
It is quite remarkable, isn't it? A company with that kind of legacy finding itself at what feels like a genuine inflection point. Mm-hmm. It just shows even the biggest players, the ones with brands everyone knows, they aren't immune. Market forces shift and you have to adapt, sometimes pretty aggressively.
Okay, let's unpack this then. A company founded way back in 1870, still mm-hmm. family controlled. That feels almost impossible today, especially for a big public company. What does that actually mean for how they run things, how they make decisions compared to, a typical corporation?
Well, that family control is absolutely central. It really fosters stability and, crucially, a long-term view. It all started with George Garvin Brown in Louisville, Kentucky, 1870. His promise was simple but bold, nothing better in the market. And that focus on quality, it still seems to guide them today. Over 155 years, they've grown into one of the biggest American-owned spirits and wine companies globally. We're talking operations in over 170 countries, more than 40 brands in the portfolio, and around 5,700 employees across the world. Now, that family control, it's structured through a dual-class share system. Basically, there are Class A shares and Class B shares. The Brown family holds the Class A shares, which carry the voting power. The Class B shares are what the public typically trades, and they don't have voting rights on major decisions.
Ah, okay. So the family calls the shots, even if they don't own, say, over 50% of the actual economic value.
Exactly. And that structure profoundly shapes their strategy. It allows for an incredibly long investment horizon. Think about aging whiskey. You're making investments today for a product you might not sell for 10, 12, even more years.
Right. Most public companies driven by quarterly results just couldn't do that.
Precisely. That long view is baked into Brown-Forman's DNA. It lets them ride out market bumps without panicking, focusing on generational value rather than just the next quarter. But the flip side, as you pointed out, is that public shareholders, the Class B holders, have very little direct say. They're essentially trusting the family's leadership and long-term vision.
That makes a ton of sense for a product where patience literally pays off.
Yeah.
So when we think Brown-Forman, the giant in the room is obviously Jack Daniel's. It's everywhere. Tell us a bit about its role and maybe some of the other key players in their lineup.
Oh, Jack Daniel's isn't just a cornerstone. It's really the foundation, the bedrock for their revenue, their profits, their global identity. You've got the classic old number 7 Tennessee whiskey, of course, but also premium versions like Gentleman Jack, the single barrel selections. They've been hugely successful with the flavored versions, Tennessee Honey, Tennessee Apple, Tennessee Fire. Those have really brought new people into the brand, different occasions. It's just an incredibly powerful global asset. One of the most recognized brands on the planet, frankly, not just in spirits.
So Jack Daniel's is massive, a true behemoth. But being so big, is it almost a victim of its own success when it comes to growth? I mean, how much bigger can a brand that's already everywhere possibly get?
That's a really critical point you raise. It's a paradox, isn't it? Jack Daniel's is this amazing cash machine, incredibly stable, but because it's so huge, its organic net sales growth for the core, Tennessee whiskey was only, 1% in fiscal 2025?
Wow, just 1%.
Yeah, It shows that while Jack Daniel's provides this immense stability, this reliable cash flow, it's kind of like its own mature economy. It's not where the explosive growth is likely to come from anymore. So Brown-Forman needs to, let's say, farm that consistent cash flow from Jack Daniel's while also hunting for new growth engines elsewhere in their portfolio. And it absolutely highlights a concentration risk. If something seriously dented Jack Daniel's reputation or sales, the whole company would feel it deeply. And that's exactly why the success of their other premium bourbons is so vital. Especially Woodford Reserve and Old Forester, these aren't just sidekicks, they're the designated growth drivers now.
Okay, so they're the rising stars then.
Absolutely. Look at Woodford Reserve. It's been fantastic. An 8% organic net sales jump in fiscal 2025. It keeps gaining market share, consistently beating the overall U.S. whiskey category. Woodford really hits that spot for consumers looking for something more premium, maybe a bit more craft-oriented. And Old Forester, which is actually Brown-Forman's original bourbon brand from 1870, it also showed high single-digit organic growth. That's mainly driven by its super premium stuff, like the 1920 Prohibition style or the sought-after birthday bourbon.
Right, those really special editions.
Exactly. So the strategy is clear. Use these brands to diversify their American whiskey growth, reduce that dependence on Jack Daniel's alone, and capture that premium end of the market.
It sounds like a smart play. Build up the supporting cast around the superstar, move people up the price ladder within whiskey. But what about looking beyond whiskey? How are they doing in categories like tequila or rum? Can they replicate that whiskey magic elsewhere?
Well, that's where the picture gets a bit more, let's say, mixed. It shows how challenging it can be to branch out, even for a company with their expertise. Take tequila. They own Herradura, which plays in the ultra-premium space, and El Jimador, more of a premium brand. But in fiscal 2025, their tequila business actually faced pretty strong headwinds. Organic net sales dropped by double digits.
Double digits? Ouch. What happened there?
It seems to be a combination of things. Really intense competition in the U.S. tequila market. You know, tons of new brands, celebrity tequilas popping up everywhere, plus some challenging economic conditions down in Mexico, which is a key market for those brands. So it suggests that maybe their execution or competitive advantages aren't quite as strong when they step outside their core American whiskey wheelhouse. But on the other hand, they are seeing some real bright spots in newer emerging categories, particularly ready-to-drinks or RTDs.
Yes, the canned cocktails and mixes.
Exactly. That's the fastest growing part of the whole spirits industry globally right now. And Brown-Forman's RTD portfolio grew a pretty healthy 5% organically last fiscal year. Part of that is their existing New Mix brand in Mexico, which is popular. But the really huge move, the one getting all the attention, is the global launch of the Jack Daniel's and Coca-Cola RTD.
Yeah, you see that everywhere now.
You do. It's a massive strategic partnership. They're leveraging the incredible global distribution and brand power of both Jack Daniel's and Coca-Cola. It's a completely different playbook aimed at capturing a huge, fast-growing market.
That Jack and Coke RTD partnership does feel like a really shrewd, almost obvious move in hindsight, targeting mass appeal.
Yeah.
But for a premium brand like Jack Daniel's, is there any risk there? Could going so mass market with an RTD potentially, you know, dilute the core brand image, alienate the traditional whiskey drinkers? And I know they've also been active buying brands, Diplomatical Rum, Gin Mare. How are those fitting in? Are they performing as hoped, or are there maybe some wrinkles there too?
That's a really good question about brand dilution. It's definitely a tightrope they have to walk. The idea with the RTD, I think, is less about converting hardcore whiskey drinkers and more about introducing the Jack Daniel's flavor profile to a much broader audience, maybe younger consumers, people who wouldn't typically pour and eat whiskey.
Like a gateway product.
Kind of, yeah. The hope is maybe some of those RTD drinkers eventually explore the main Jack Daniel's line. So far, the market seems to be embracing it, suggesting the strategic benefit is outweighing dilution concerns for now. But it's absolutely something they need to watch carefully. As for the acquisitions, yes, Diplomatico Rum and Gin Mare were clear moves to get into super premium rum and gin, diversifying their high-end offerings. Diplomatico seems to be doing well, showing strong double-digit growth, which fits right into their premiumization strategy. That's a positive sign. Gin Mare, though, there's a bit of a hiccup. They actually took a $47 million non-cash impairment charge on the Gin Mare brand name in fiscal 2025.
Okay, what does an impairment charge mean exactly? Is that like a loss?
It's not a direct cash loss right now, but it's an accounting adjustment. It basically means the company has reassessed the future earning potential of that brand name and decided it's worth less than they previously thought. It could signal some integration challenges, or maybe the European gin market, where gin mare is strong, turned out to be tougher or more volatile than they expected when they bought it.
Okay.
So it does raise that question again. Is there expansion into new categories, especially buying brands versus building them, as smooth and effective as their deep focus on American whiskey? The results seem a bit uneven so far.
Okay, so they're a global company, clearly.
Yeah.
But where are the sales actually happening? Is it booming everywhere, or are some regions strong while others are lagging? Is there a geographical story unfolding?
Oh, definitely. Geographically, it's quite a mixed bag right now, which really reflects the different economic situations around the world. The U.S. market, which is their biggest and most crucial market by far, actually faced some real challenges in fiscal 2025. Net sales there decreased by 2% organically.
A decrease in the U.S. That's significant.
It is. It was mainly driven by lower volumes for the core Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey, suggesting that slowdown in premium spending is hitting home. There were also some business model changes affecting their Jack Daniel's Country Cocktails brand that contributed. Developed international markets didn't fare much better either. Places like Europe and Australia saw a combined 3% organic net sales decline. Now, part of that was planned because they sold off the Finlandia vodka brand, but they also saw lower volumes in key spots like Italy, South Korea, and the UK, likely reflecting broader economic softness and tough competition in those developed economies.
Okay, so the big established markets are struggling a bit. Where is the growth coming from then? Is there a bright spot anywhere on the map?
Yes, there is. The most significant growth engine for them geographically has been emerging markets. These regions collectively delivered a strong 9% organic net sales increase in fiscal 2025.
9%. Okay, that's much better. Where specifically?
Yeah. They saw standout performances in places like Turkey, Brazil, and the United Arab Emirates. You're seeing rising incomes, growing middle classes, and a real thirst for established premium Western brands in many of these areas. So this really highlights how crucial global expansion is for Brown-Forman's future growth, especially when their traditional strongholds are facing these headwinds. It's essential to offset that slowdown.
And pulling it all together across all these different brands and regions, what's their main game plan, their market positioning? Are they trying to be cheap and cheerful or aiming higher?
Their strategy is crystal clear and has been for a long time. They are laser focused on the premium end of the market. Premium, super premium, ultra premium, that's where Brown-Forman lives almost exclusively. It's not just marketing, it's built into how they make their products, the quality, the aging. Management often talks about their portfolio being the strongest it has ever been and perfectly positioned for that long-term consumer trend of drinking better, not more.
So they're really betting on quality over quantity.
Absolutely. And this premium focus brings real advantages. It gives them significant pricing power, the ability to charge more. That leads to strong gross margins. Their gross margin was nearly 59% in fiscal 2025, which is quite healthy. It also creates higher barriers to entry. It takes a lot of time, money, and consistent quality to build a brand that people will pay a premium for. It's much harder for competitors to just jump in and challenge them at that level. It's a strategic bet on the enduring appeal of quality. #2, the shifting sands of the spirits industry.
That premiumization trend, we've heard about it for years. It sounds like Brown-Forman really leaned into it, and it paid off with those margins.
Yeah.
But let's zoom out for a second. What's the bigger picture in the global spirits industry right now? What are the main currents shaping things?
Yeah, it's a good idea to look at the wider context. The global spirits market is, well, massive and surprisingly resilient through economic ups and downs. Estimates for 2025 put the total market value somewhere between, say, $414 billion and maybe $656 billion. It's a huge range, but the point is, it's enormous. And analysts project it'll keep growing at mid-single digit rates each year, potentially hitting somewhere near $750 to $790 billion by the early 2030s.
Wow. So still plenty of growth ahead then. What's driving that?
Several powerful long-term trends have been pushing it forward. First, as you said, premiumization. That's been the biggest value driver for years. Consumers trading up, paying more for quality, craft, authentic stories, especially in whiskey and tequila. Second, the rise of cocktail culture globally. People making more sophisticated drinks at home, higher expectations at bars. That fuels demand for a wider range of premium spirits. And third, constant innovation. New flavors, interesting packaging, and especially the demand for convenience, which is where things like RTDs come in. The industry is always adapting to what consumers want next.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting and maybe a bit worrying for a company like Brown-Forman. We always talk about premiumization being this unstoppable force, this tailwind. But I'm hearing now, maybe that's hitting a wall. is that trend actually slowing down?
Yeah.
And if it is, what does that mean for a company that's basically bet the farm on it?
You've hit the nail on the head. This is arguably the biggest immediate headwind for the entire industry. And yes, Brown-Forman's own CEO has acknowledged this recently. Multiple industry reports coming out in 2024, early 2025, are suggesting that premiumization is showing serious signs of slowing, even stalling.
Stalling, or yeah. Even dead, I think I read somewhere.
Some reports have used language that strong, like stagnant or all but dead in the near term. The reason? Persistent inflation, higher interest rates, general economic uncertainty. It's making consumers much more careful with their spending, more value conscious. It's not that people suddenly don't want premium products, but they might be thinking twice before splurging. It's a subtle shift, but it puts real pressure on companies like Brown-Forman, whose strategy relies heavily on consumers trading up. They might need to adjust pricing, promotions, maybe focus more on value within their premium tiers. And beyond that core trend slowing, there are other big shifts happening too. RTDs, as we mentioned, are just exploding, especially spirits-based ones. In the U.S., revenue was up something like 27% year-over-year recently. They hit that sweet spot of convenience, quality, lower alcohol sometimes, especially for younger drinkers. That's a huge area of growth, but also fierce competition.
Right. And what about health trends? The whole low alcohol, no alcohol thing?
That's definitely growing too. The no-low category, no and low alcohol, is gaining traction, particularly with Gen Z. For traditional spirits companies, that's both a potential threat if people drink less traditional alcohol, but also an opportunity to innovate and offer those kinds of alternatives. Brown-Forman hasn't historically been a big player there. And then you always have the regulatory and geopolitical stuff hanging over the industry. High taxes, advertising restrictions, those are constant challenges. And for Brown-Forman specifically, the risk of retaliatory tariffs on American whiskey is always lurking. We saw that impact them a few years ago during trade disputes, and it could easily happen again, hitting their international sales and margins hard.
So it's a complex landscape. Economic pressures, changing tastes, regulatory hurdles. Given all that, how does Brown-Forman actually stack up against his main rivals? Are they competing against giants? Or do they have their own protected corner of the market?
Oh, they are definitely competing against giants. The global spirits market is pretty consolidated at the top. You've got Diageo, they're the biggest fish by far, market cap around $59 billion. Their portfolio is incredibly diverse. Johnny Walker, Smirnoff, Tanqueray, Don Julio, they're in almost every category. Mm-hmm. Then there's Pernod Ricard, number two globally. Think Absolut, Jameson, Chivas Regal. They're also facing some headwinds right now, especially in the U.S. and China. And maybe most relevant for Brown-Forman, you have Suntory Global Spirits. They're a major force, especially in American whiskey, with brands like Jim Beam, Maker's Mark, Knob Creek, right up against Brown-Forman's core.
Okay, so big competition. Mm. How does Brown-Forman differentiate itself then? What's their angle?
Their angle is really depth versus the breadth of Diageo or Pernod Ricard. While the giants play across the board, Brown-Forman gets most of its value, its identity, from American whiskey. They absolutely dominate that category. In the U.S., their market share is estimated around 34%, way ahead of some Tories, like 16%.
34%? Wow, that's huge.
It is. That focus gives them deep expertise, authenticity, real pricing power within that category. They are masters of American whiskey, but it's also their vulnerability, right? It makes them much more exposed if consumer tastes were to suddenly shift away from American whiskey in a big way. Their diversified competitors could weather that kind of storm more easily. It's a focused bet, a high-stakes one.
That makes sense. It's a focused bet, but it sounds like a pretty well-defended one. It can't be easy for a new company to just decide, hey, let's make premium whiskey
right. And
compete with Jack Daniel's or Woodford Reserve. What are the main roadblocks, the barriers to entry that protect companies like Brown-Forman?
You're absolutely right. The barriers to entry in this premium aged spirits business are incredibly high. It creates a really strong economic moat. First off, you have brand equity. You just can't replicate over 150 years of history and brand building like Jack Daniel's has. That global recognition, that consumer loyalty, that cultural resonance. It's basically priceless and impossible for a newcomer to create quickly.
Right. You can't just invent heritage.
Exactly. Second, the sheer cost and time involved in the aging process. It's massively capital intensive. You have to invest millions up front to distill spirits, put them in expensive barrels, and then just wait. For years,
yeah. Sometimes
decades, while all that capital is tied up in inventory, sitting in a warehouse.
That requires incredibly deep pockets and patience.
Immense patience. Very few startups can afford to wait that long for a return. It's a huge financial barrier. It also means Brown-Forman constantly has to predict demand years in advance, tying up huge sums based on forecasts. That's a tricky balancing act itself. Misjudge it, and you either have shortages or excess inventory sitting around. And finally, distribution. Getting your product onto shelves around the world is incredibly complex, expensive, and often heavily regulated. Established players like Brown-Forman have these deep, long-standing relationships with distributors and retailers, navigating that complex three-tier system. It's very hard for a new brand to break into those networks and get the attention they need. So yeah, those three things, brand equity, capital for aging, and distribution access, create a very formidable moat.
Okay, so we understand the strategy, the market, the competition, the moats. How has all this translated into actual financial performance? Looking back over, say, the last decade, what's the story the numbers tell, and how are they holding up more recently with these headwinds?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the numbers show a company that's been remarkably resilient and successful over the long haul, but definitely sensitive to economic shifts, even with that premium focus. Looking at the last decade or so, Brown-Forman has a really strong track record. Consistent growth, good profitability, creating value for shareholders, that's the baseline. Their revenue grew pretty steadily from around $3 billion back in fiscal 2014 up to a peak of about $4.2 billion in fiscal 2023. Solid expansion. But then, reflecting these challenges we've discussed, revenue dipped in fiscal 2025 down to just under $4 billion, around $3.98 billion. So definitely a recent downturn within a longer-term growth story.
Is this downturn unusual for them, or have they seen dips like this before?
It's not unprecedented. They had a similar, though maybe less sharp, slowdown back around fiscal 2016-2017, so they've navigated cycles before. What feels different this time is maybe the combination of the broader economic pressure and this huge internal distribution shift happening simultaneously. Profitability-wise, they've historically been very strong. Key metrics like return on equity or ROE, basically how much profit they generate from shareholders' investments, have been consistently high. It's moderated a bit from its peaks, but for the last 12 months ending April 2025, ROE was still a very healthy 23.2%.
Okay, 23% is pretty good.
It is. And another one, return on invested capital, ROIC, which measures how well they generate profit from all the capital they use, debt and equity, that was also strong at 14.4% in fiscal 2025. These numbers show they're generally efficient at allocating capital, but again, these figures have come down from previous highs, reflecting the pressure on sales and higher costs recently.
You mentioned pressure on profitability and higher costs. Can we drill down into their margins? What's been happening there? Are costs for things like grain, glass, barrels squeezing them? Or is it more about pricing and consumer demand?
It's really a bit of both impacting margins right now. They're definitely feeling the squeeze. Their gross margin, that's the profit left after the direct costs of making the product, it contracted by 150 basis points in fiscal 2025.
So 1.5 percentage points lower. Why was that?
Two main drivers they cited. One was significantly higher input costs, things like agave for their tequilas and glass for bottles across the board got more expensive. The other factor was what they call unfavorable fixed cost absorption. Because they produce lower volumes overall, those fixed costs of running the distilleries, the buildings, the equipment, the core staff got spread over fewer units. That makes each bottle cost a bit more to produce.
Ah, the factory running below full capacity effect. Makes sense.
Exactly. Like that bakery analogy, same rent. Fewer loaves sold means higher cost per loaf. And that pressure flowed down to their operating margin, too. While still strong at nearly 28% in fiscal 2025, that was a pretty big drop, 600 basis points, or 6 percentage points from the year before. That was partly the lower gross margin, but also significantly, the prior year's results had been boosted by gains from selling off brands like Sonoma Cutter Wines and Finlandia Vodka. Without those one-off gains in fiscal 2025, the underlying decline looked sharper. So yes, still very profitable, but the trend on margins has clearly been downward recently due to these combined pressures.
Okay, margins are under pressure. But what about cash flow? That's crucial, right? Especially for a business that has to invest so much in inventory that sits aging for years. Are they still generating enough cash? Or is that inventory build a major drain?
Yes, cash flow is absolutely critical, and despite the margin pressure, Brown-Forman continues to generate strong cash flow from its operations. That's really a hallmark of a quality consumer staples business like theirs. For the 12 months ending April 2025, their cash from operations was nearly $600 million, $598 million to be precise. Now, they do have significant capital expenditures investments in maintaining and expanding their distilleries, warehouses, equipment. That was about $167 million $1,000 in the same period. So after accounting for that CapEx, their free cash flow, the cash left over for things like dividends, buybacks, or paying down debt, was still a healthy $431 million.
Okay, so still generating decent free cash flow then.
They are, which is vital because it funds those shareholder returns we'll talk about and gives them financial flexibility. But you like to flag the inventory challenge. That long aging process requires a huge ongoing investment in inventory. Just look at fiscal 2024. Their inventory increased by $349 million. That's a massive use of cash in 1 year.
Wow, nearly $350 million just tied up in barrels.
Exactly. It's this strategic paradox. They have to make these investments years in advance to ensure they have enough aged product to meet future demand for Woodford Reserve, Old Forester, premium Jack Daniel's expressions. It absolutely constrains near-term free cash flow compared to, say, a tech company with no physical inventory. But it's essential for their long-term strategy and premium positioning. It requires incredible forecasting and capital discipline.
And thinking about that capital discipline, what about their overall financial health? You mentioned the inventory build, the CapEx. Are they managing this with a strong balance sheet? How much debt are they carrying, especially going into this distribution overhaul?
Their balance sheet looks quite solid, actually. Pretty strong and flexible, which is good news given the current environment and the changes they're undertaking. As of the end of April 2025, they had about $2.7 billion in total debt. Compared to total equity of roughly $4 billion, that gives them a total debt-to-equity ratio of about 0.68.
Okay. Is 0.68 considered high or low?
That's generally considered quite manageable, even conservative, for a company of this size and stability. It gives them plenty of financial firepower if they need it for acquisitions, investments, or just weathering storms. And they showed good discipline recently, too. They paid back $300 million in senior notes that came due in April 2025, using cash on hand rather than taking on new debt. So, despite the headwinds and the big investments, their financial foundation seems very robust. They have flexibility.
Okay, so a strong foundation, but definitely navigating some choppy waters right now with the premium slowdown and mixed results outside whiskey. So how is management steering the ship? What are the core strategic priorities to get back on a smoother course and drive future growth?
Their core long-term strategy hasn't fundamentally changed. It's still all about building premium and super premium global brands with American whiskey right at the heart of it. That's their strength. Within that, management has outlined several key priorities. First, they're sticking with driving premiumization, even if the market's tough right now. That means continuing to innovate at the high end. Think about those Jack Daniel's 10-year-old and 12-year-old releases. Very successful, command high prices, appeal to enthusiasts.
Like keeping the top end exciting.
Exactly. And they're putting significant marketing muscle and focus behind brands like Woodford Reserve, ensuring it keeps growing faster than the category and attracting those discerning drinkers. Second priority is what they call active portfolio management. This isn't static. They're constantly looking at their stable of brands. Does each brand fit the strategy? Is it delivering growth and margins? We saw this clearly with the sales of Finlandia Vodka and Sonoma Cutter Wines Good brands, but not core to their premium spirits future.
So trimming the less strategic parts?
Right. And at the same time, making targeted acquisitions to fill gaps or enter new attractive premium categories. Diplomatico Rum and Gin Mare fit that mold, even with the Gin Mare impairment we discussed. It's about sharpening the focus. And the third major pillar is geographic expansion, but also taking more control over how they reach consumers internationally. They've been deliberately shifting towards setting up their own distribution networks in key markets outside the U.S. By the end of fiscal 2024, they were handling their own distribution in 16 countries, including recent moves into important places like Japan and Italy.
Why do that? Isn't using local distributors easier?
It might seem easier initially, but owning distribution gives them more control and better economics long term. They capture the margin that would otherwise go to the distributor. Their sales teams are 100% focused on selling Brown-Forman products, not juggling multiple brands. They can build deeper relationships with bars and retailers. It's a strategic move to accelerate growth and improve profitability in key international markets.
Taking more control internationally makes sense. But speaking of distribution, they just announced this absolutely massive change to how they do things in the U.S. You said the first major overhaul in over 60 years. So this isn't just a tweak. This is a monumental shift. What does short-term disruption really mean for you as a consumer or someone watching this company as an investor? What's the real potential impact here?
Monumental is the right word. It really is a historic change announced in May 2025. For over six decades, they've had a certain way of working with distributors across the U.S., And now they're completely revamping it. They're consolidating their business, moving towards fewer, larger partners with national scale. Breakthrough Beverage Group, for example, is set to become their largest national distributor, handling their brands across 13 states.
Okay, so fewer, bigger relationships. What's the thinking behind that?
Management's rationale is that aligning with these larger scaled partners will ultimately simplify their route to market, provide greater focus on their premium portfolio, and unlock significant long-term growth by leveraging the resources and reach of these big distributors. Accelerate the premium strategy, basically. But, and this is the crucial part for anyone watching, they've been very clear and upfront that this massive transition will almost certainly cause significant short-term disruption. They expect sales volatility, particularly in the first half of their fiscal 2026, which started around May 2025.
So what does that disruption look like on the ground?
For you as a consumer, maybe your favorite store temporarily has trouble getting Woodford Reserve or a specific Jack Daniel's expression as the logistics shift. Maybe bars have temporary outages. For investors, it means bracing for potentially weaker sales numbers for a quarter or two. Maybe higher initial costs as the new systems ramp up. There's even a risk of losing some shelf space or momentum temporarily if the transition isn't perfectly smooth.
So potentially painful in the short term.
Potentially, yes. They believe it's necessary pain for long-term gain, streamlining operations and setting them up better for the future. But the execution risk is very real and significant. It's probably the single biggest thing to watch for them operationally over the next year or so.
Okay, so a huge focus on fixing the pikes, the distribution. While that's happening, how are they keeping the innovation engine running? You mentioned the Jack and Coke RTD. What else is cooking? And how important is new stuff for their growth?
Innovation remains absolutely vital, even during this transition. They can't afford to stand still on the product front. The Jack Daniel's and Coca-Cola RTD is definitely the flagship innovation right now. It's just such a massive opportunity, tapping into the huge brand recognition and distribution might of both companies in that booming RTD segment. The goal there is clearly to bring new consumers into the Jack Daniel's world via a convenient, familiar format, hoping some will trade up later. It's a direct play for volume and relevance with changing consumer habits. But they're also continuing their successful strategy of innovating within their core brands. They know how to do line extensions well.
Like the flavored Jack Daniel's.
Exactly. They've got Jack Daniel's Tennessee Blackberry coming up soon. That follows the same successful pattern as Tennessee Honey, Fire, and Apple, which brought incremental growth and kept the core brand feeling fresh. They do similar things with Woodford Reserve special releases, Old Forester limited editions. It's about maintaining excitement, giving consumers reasons to engage with the brands, and capturing different occasions, even while the core product remains consistent. It's a key part of their growth playbook.
And what about the digital side of things? We live in an online world. Is Brown-Forman leveraging data, e-commerce, AI to compete more effectively?
They are definitely moving in that direction strategically, though maybe not as visibly as some other consumer goods companies, partly due to the complexities of alcohol regulations. They are investing significantly in data analytics and AI. For instance, using AI to build sophisticated models that predict how sensitive sales are to price changes elasticity models. That helps them optimize pricing and promotions in different markets around the world for better profitability.
Smart. Using data for pricing.
Right. And also using data to measure the effectiveness of their marketing investments. Like, how much impact did that big Kentucky Derby sponsorship really have? Trying to get smarter about where they spend their marketing dollars. On the e-commerce and direct-to-consumer DTC front, it's more nascent but still strategic. They've partnered with platforms like BigCommerce to set up online shops for certain brands like Old Forester, especially for selling limited edition bottlings directly to consumers where the laws allow.
Is that a big sales channel for them yet?
Probably not in terms of overall volume.
Right.
The state-by-state shipping laws for alcohol in the U.S. make large-scale DTC very complicated. But it's strategically valuable for other reasons. It allows them to capture first-party consumer data, who's buying, what they like. That data is gold for refining products and marketing. It also builds direct relationships and brand loyalty, even if it's not moving huge volumes yet. It's about building for the future and learning directly from their consumers.
It sounds like Brown-Forman is definitely investing heavily in its future, fixing distribution, innovating, going digital. But companies also need to return value to their shareholders. How does Brown-Forman balance those growth investments with things like dividends and share buybacks? Are they known for being shareholder friendly?
Oh, absolutely. Returning capital to shareholders is a fundamental part of their identity and strategy, and they have the strong, consistent cash flow we talked about earlier to support it. Their dividend record is, frankly, exceptional. Brown-Forman is what's known as a dividend aristocrat, part of the S&P 500 index of companies that have increased their dividend for at least 25 consecutive years.
Okay, 25 years is impressive.
It is, but Brown-Forman's record is even better. They've actually increased their regular dividend for an incredible 41 consecutive years, and they've paid a regular quarterly dividend without fail for 81 years straight.
Wow, 41 years of increases. That's serious consistency.
It really signals a deep commitment to returning cash to shareholders and reflects the underlying stability of their business over decades. Just in fiscal 2025, they paid out $420 million in regular dividends. They manage this sustainably, too. Their payout ratio, the proportion of their earnings that they pay out as dividends, is typically kept around a reasonable level, currently about 48%. That means they're rewarding shareholders consistently, but also retaining enough earnings to reinvest back into the business for future growth. And occasionally, when cash builds up, they've even paid out special one-off dividends on top of the regular ones, like a $1 per share special dividend back in December 2021.
That's a fantastic dividend track record. What about the other main way companies return cash, buying back their own stock? Is Brown-Forman active on that front?
Yes, they use share repurchase programs opportunistically as another tool in their capital allocation toolkit. The board authorizes these programs, giving management the green light to buy back Class A and Class B shares in the open market when they feel the price is attractive. The idea is that buying back shares reduces the total number of shares outstanding, which can boost earnings per share and signals management's confidence in the company's value. For example, they had a $400 million repurchase authorization approved in October 2023, running through October 2024. As of late 2023, they still had about $181 million left under that program. So it shows a consistent approach. Dividends are the primary steady return method, while buybacks are used more flexibly when conditions seem right.
Okay, so strong commitment to dividends, opportunistic buybacks. What about the capital they keep? Where are the main priorities for reinvesting back into the business itself? And what's the spending outlook there?
The lion's share of their capital expenditures, or CapEx, goes towards organic growth and maintaining their significant asset base. This means investing in expanding production capacity, building new warehouses for aging whiskey, upgrading distillery equipment to make sure they can meet projected future demand. It also includes meticulously maintaining their existing facilities, which are large and complex, and investing in sustainability projects across their operations.
So keeping the core engine running and growing.
Exactly. Looking ahead, for fiscal 2026, their CapEx guidance is between $125 million and $135 million. That's actually a step down from the $180 to $190 million they planned for fiscal 2025. This might suggest that some major capacity expansion projects are winding down, leading to a bit of moderation in spending after a period of higher investment. And beyond that organic CapEx, they also allocate capital strategically for those portfolio moves we discussed, acquisitions like Diplomatico to add growth, and divestitures like the recent sale of their stake in the Duckhorn portfolio. That Duckhorn deal, for instance, brought in $350 million in cash in fiscal 2025, which gives them even more financial flexibility for other priorities, whether it's debt repayment, share buybacks, or future investments. It's all part of that dynamic capital allocation process.
All right. No deep dive is complete without looking at the potential pitfalls. Mm-hmm. Even for a company as established and seemingly solid as Brown-Forman, there have to be risks. Given their focus on whiskey, their premium strategy, and this huge distribution shift, what are the major minefields they need to navigate? What are the big worries?
You're right. Every company faces risks, and Brown-Forman is no exception. They have a complex set, some industry-wide, some quite specific to them. Probably the biggest single business risk is their heavy reliance on the Jack Daniel's family of brands. It's their crown jewel, yes, but also their potential Achilles heel. Any significant damage to the Jack Daniel's brand, a major quality issue, a big marketing blunder, a sustained shift away from it would have a truly material negative impact across the entire company's financials. The concentration is significant.
So protecting Jack is priority number one, two, and three.
Pretty much. Then there's the risk of shifting consumer preferences, which we've touched on. The drinks market changes constantly, a major long-term move away from brown spirits generally, or a sustained rejection of premium price points due to economic hardship, or maybe a much faster shift towards non-alcoholic options, or even legal cannabis cutting into alcohol's share of wallet. Any of those could really hurt their core business model. Operational risks are always there too, especially with aged spirits. Those long lead times create significant inventory risk. Predicting demand years out is hard. And think about catastrophic events. A major fire or natural disaster at the Jack Daniel Distillery in Lynchburg, Tennessee, that could cripple their supply of their flagship brand for years. There's no quick fix for aged inventory.
Yeah, you can't just quickly make more 10-year-old whiskey.
Exactly. They also face volatility in raw material costs. Corn, barley, agave for tequila, and especially the American white oak needed for barrels. Price spikes or shortages there can squeeze margins. And we have to come back to the U.S. distribution overhaul. The execution risk there is huge. A messy transition could lead to lost sales, damaged relationships with crucial distributors and retailers, higher costs. Management knows this, they've flagged it, but pulling off such a massive change smoothly is a major challenge. It's a big operational risk in the near term. Finally, broader economic conditions, recessions, high inflation cutting into disposable income, weak consumer confidence, all these things directly impact spending on premium spirits as we're seeing play out right now.
Those are some significant operational and market risks. What about factors completely outside their control? Things like global politics, trade wars, changing laws, currency swings?
Yes, those external geopolitical and regulatory risks are a constant factor for any global company. Trade policy is a big one for Brown-Forman. As a major U.S. exporter, particularly of American whiskey, they are very vulnerable to retaliatory tariffs from other countries. We saw this a few years back with EU tariffs, and it directly impacted their costs, margins, and sales volumes internationally. That threat hasn't gone away. Foreign currency fluctuations also matter. They sell in many currencies, but report results in U.S. dollars. So when the dollar is strong, like it has been recently, those international sales translate back into fewer dollars, making reported growth look weaker.
The strong dollar headwind.
Exactly. And just operating in over 170 countries means exposure to all sorts of political risks, instability, social unrest, sanctions, anything that could disrupt business in a particular region. On the regulatory side, the alcohol industry faces constant scrutiny. Taxes are always a risk. Higher excise duties or sales taxes can dampen demand by making products more expensive. We could also see stricter rules around marketing, advertising, or where and how alcohol can be sold. Compliance costs can rise. And there's that longer-term societal risk. If public health concerns lead to a significant decline in the social acceptability of alcohol, that could result in much tougher regulations and fundamentally lower consumption in key markets over time.
Okay, one last area of risk governance. We talked right at the beginning about the unique family control through that dual class share structure. Mm-hmm. What are the specific risks or implications there? You mentioned the stability it brings, but what's the potential downside for public investors? For you as an investor, how do you weigh that long-term stability against the limited direct influence?
That's a really important question, and it goes to the heart of investing in a controlled company like Brown-Forman. As we established, the Brown family controls the majority of the voting power via the Class A shares. This means they effectively control the board of directors and major strategic decisions. The big pro, as we've discussed, is that it facilitates that crucial long-term thinking, insulating management from short-term market pressures ideal for aging spirits. Stability. Continuity. The con, however, is that the public shareholders, the holders of the Class B stock, have virtually no say in these major decisions. They can't vote on directors, mergers, or significant strategic shifts. Their power is essentially limited to buying or selling the stock. So as an investor, you are placing a significant amount of trust in the Brown family stewardship. You're betting that their interests, given their large economic stake, will generally align with yours. And historically, that alignment seems to have worked well, given the company's long-term success. But there's always the theoretical risk that the family's interests might diverge from public shareholders on certain issues.
Like what, for example?
Maybe they prioritize legacy projects or community investments or maintaining family control above maximizing short-term shareholder returns in a way an independent board might not. Or perhaps they might be slower to make difficult changes if it impacts long-standing relationships or traditions. It's a trade-off. You potentially get better long-term strategic focus and stability, but you give up the direct accountability and influence that comes with voting rights in a typical public company. It's something each investor needs to weigh based on their own philosophy.
Okay, we've covered the business, the industry, the finances, the strategy, the risks. Now, the crucial question, what about the price? How is Brown-Forman valued in the market right now, especially compared to those big competitors like Diageo? And how does it look versus its own history? Is it trading at a premium, or does the current slowdown make it look like a potential bargain?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Historically, Brown-Forman has consistently traded at a significant valuation premium compared to its larger, more diversified peers like Diageo or Pernod Ricard. You can see this in the multiples. For example, looking at enterprise value to trailing sales, Brown-Forman, BFB, is around 6.1x, whereas Diageo is closer to 3.8x. On an EV to EBITDA basis, Brown-Forman is near 17x, while Diageo is more like 11x or 12x.
So quite a bit richer valuation. Why has the market paid that premium historically?
It's generally been justified by Brown-Forman's superior performance track record. Historically, they've delivered stronger organic growth, particularly driven by American whiskey's boom. They've had higher profit margins due to that premium focus, and they've generated exceptional returns on capital. Investors were willing to pay up for that quality, consistency, and leadership in a very attractive category. But the big question today is whether that historical premium is still fully warranted, given the current environment. With Brown-Forman's growth slowing, their near-term outlook cautious, and the premiumization trend itself under pressure across the industry, the market seems to be asking that same question. You can see this reflected in the stock price performance. Brown-Forman has significantly underperformed its peers and the broader market over the past year or so, down quite sharply. It suggests the market is recalibrating that premium, pricing in the current headwinds, and the execution risk of the distribution changes.
Okay, so it's still expensive relative to peers, even after the drop, but maybe less so than it used to be. What about compared to its own historical valuation range? Has the stock price decline brought it back to a more reasonable level compared to where it typically trades?
Yes, that's a really important distinction. While it might still look pricey next to Diageo on some metrics compared to its own history, Brown-Forman's valuation has definitely become much more reasonable, arguably even attractive for long-term investors. Its current trailing price-to-earnings PE ratio is down around 22 or 23. That's significantly lower than its five-year average PE, which was often well above 30.
So a big compression there.
A very big compression. Similarly, its price-to-sales ratio is now around 3.4, whereas its five-year average was closer to 7. So the takeaway is, yes, it might still carry a premium versus some competitors, reflecting its quality and niche focus, but relative to where investors have been willing to value it in recent years, it's trading at a substantial discount. The market has definitely baked in a lot of the current negativity.
For investors trying to figure out an actual intrinsic value, maybe using a discounted cash flow model or something similar, what are the really critical assumptions you need to make for Brown-Forman right now, given all these moving parts, the slowdown, the transition, the long-term potential?
Building a DCF for Brown-Forman right now requires making some careful and frankly uncertain assumptions. It's not straightforward. First, growth rates. You'd likely start with management's guidance for fiscal 2026, that low single-digit decline due to the distribution changes and market softness. Then you'd have to model a gradual recovery back towards mid-single-digit growth in the following years, assuming the strategy works, the market recovers, and premiumization resumes. That recovery pace is a huge variable. Second, margins. You'd model near-term pressure reflecting higher input costs and the disruption. Then maybe a gradual expansion back towards their historical levels over time, banking on synergies from the new distribution setup, easing cost inflation, and their pricing power eventually kicking back in. Again, the timing and magnitude of that margin recovery are key. Third, the discount rate, or WACC. This would likely be relatively low compared to the overall market. Brown-Forman is a consumer staples company, less economically sensitive than many others, and its stock has a low beta, around 0.6, meaning it's less volatile than the market average. That stability lowers the required rate of return.
So a lower discount rate helps support the valuation.
It does. And finally, the terminal value, the value assigned to cash flows beyond the explicit forecast period. You'd likely use a perpetual growth rate assumption of maybe 2% to 3%, reflecting long-term inflation and modest real growth for a mature company. But given all these uncertainties, especially around the near-term growth and margin recovery, running sensitivity analyses is absolutely essential. You'd test different assumptions, and the resulting range of intrinsic values would likely be quite wide. It really depends on how optimistic or pessimistic you are about them navigating this transition. #8, synthesis and forward look.
Okay, we have covered a lot of ground. We've dissected Brown-Forman's history, its brands, the shifting industry, the financials, the big strategy shifts, the risks, the valuation. Let's try to synthesize this. What are the core enduring strengths and competitive advantages that still make Brown-Forman a compelling company, even with the current challenges? Why should someone potentially invest?
Despite the near-term turbulence, Brown-Forman possesses some truly powerful, deeply ingrained strength that form the core of its long-term investment appeal. First and foremost is that portfolio of iconic brands led by Jack Daniel's. That brand equity is a massive economic moat, providing incredible pricing power, global recognition, and deep consumer loyalty that's very hard to erode. Second, their dominant position in American whiskey. They command huge market share in a category that, long-term, has been high growth and high margin. They are the leaders here. Third, their proven strategy focused on premiumization. Even with the current slowdown, they're perfectly positioned in the most profitable part of the spirits market, appealing to consumers seeking quality and craft. Fourth, their strong financial profile, consistent profitability, high returns on capital historically, strong cash flow generation, and a healthy balance sheet give them resilience and strategic options. And finally, that disciplined commitment to shareholder returns. The incredible dividend track record, 41 straight years of increases, makes it a reliable income play, backed by opportunistic share buybacks. These are durable advantages.
Those are definitely compelling points, the bedrock of the company. But we also have to acknowledge the current reality. What are the main red flags? The primary risks and headwinds that should make investors cautious right now, particularly in the short to medium term.
Absolutely. The caution flags are waving right now, too. The biggest concerns center around a few key areas. First, macroeconomic sensitivity. Their premium focus makes them vulnerable when consumers tighten their belts. The current slowdown in premiumization is hitting them directly, impacting volumes and potentially pricing power. How long that lasts is a major uncertainty. Second, execution risk related to that massive U.S. distribution overhaul. It's a huge, complex transition. If it doesn't go smoothly, it could cause significant disruption to sales, market share, and relationships for quite some time. That's a major near-term risk. Third, concentration risk remains. Their heavy reliance on Jack Daniel's in the American whiskey category means any negative shift specifically impacting that segment hits them harder than their more diversified competitors. And fourth, that persistent regulatory and trade uncertainty. The threat of new taxes or tariffs, especially on American whiskey internationally, is always there and could impact profitability unexpectedly. These are the main things keeping investors cautious.
So, balancing those strengths and risks, how does Brown-Forman look compared to other potential investments in the consumer staples sector? Is it still that classic, defensive, sleep-well-at-night stock? Or does the current situation make its risk-reward profile a bit different right now?
That's a great comparison. In some ways, it still fits the consumer staples mold, lower volatility than the overall market, that low beta, a very reliable and growing dividend. That defensive quality is still partly there. However, I'd argue its current risk profile is definitely elevated compared to a more plain vanilla consumer staple company, like maybe a household products giant. Why? Because Brown-Forman is facing both cyclical industry headwinds, that premiumization slowdown hitting its core strategy, and significant company-specific transition risk with the distribution overhaul. That's a double whammy of uncertainty right now.
So more potential bumps in the road than usual.
Exactly. The potential reward, of course, is that if they navigate this period successfully and the market recovers, the stock could see a significant rebound, returning to that historical premium growth trajectory. So investors today are essentially being asked to look through the near-term noise and underwrite this transition. You're accepting higher near-term uncertainty and volatility for the prospect of potentially higher long-term returns if their strategy pays off. It's a bit less sleep well at night right now and more watch closely.
That makes sense. So for those watching closely, whether investors, competitors, industry observers, or just curious listeners, what are the absolute key things to monitor? What specific metrics or developments will tell us how Brown-Forman is really doing in navigating this pivotal period? What are the actionable takeaways?
There are definitely a few critical signposts to watch. Number one, without a doubt, is U.S. organic sales growth. Seeing that number stabilize and eventually turn positive again will be the clearest signal that the core market is recovering and, crucially, that the new distribution setup is starting to work effectively. That's paramount. Second, keep a close eye on gross margin trends. Are they stabilizing? Are they starting to expand again? That will tell you if input cost pressures are easing and, importantly, if their pricing power is holding up despite the market softness. Third, watch the performance of Woodford Reserve and the rest of their super premium portfolio. Continued strong growth there is vital proof that their core premiumization strategy is still resonating and that they're successfully diversifying beyond just Jack Daniel's.
Okay, U.S. sales, gross margins, Woodford. What else?
Fourth, I'd watch the tequila portfolio performance. Can Herradura and El Jimador turn things around? improvement there would show they can execute better outside of whiskey and make those diversification efforts stick. And fifth, track the progress of the Jack Daniel's and Coca-Cola RTD globally. Are volumes growing? Are they gaining share in that critical RTD segment? Its success is a key indicator for their broader innovation and growth strategy. Those are the big ones I track.
Perfect. And just to crystallize it, looking ahead, what are the scenarios? What developments would really strengthen the case for Brown-Forman getting back on track versus what would seriously weaken it and maybe force a rethink?
Okay, the bull case. The scenario where things strengthen would look something like this. The U.S. economy avoids a hard recession, consumer confidence bounces back, and we see that premiumization trend reignite. Simultaneously, Brown-Forman executes the U.S. distribution transition smoothly, maybe even faster than expected, leading to clear market share gains and cost savings by late fiscal 2026 or 2027. Add in stronger than expected global growth from the Jack and Coke RTD and continued success in emerging markets, and the outlook brightens considerably. The bear case, the scenario where the thesis weakens, would involve a prolonged economic downturn where consumers aggressively trade down, hurting premium spirits badly. Or the U.S. distribution transition proves very disruptive, leading to sustained market share losses, operational chaos, and damaged relationships. If, on top of that, their tequila brands continue to struggle and other new innovations fail to gain traction, it would seriously challenge their ability to grow beyond the core Jack Daniel's franchise and raise doubts about the overall strategy. That would definitely warrant a reconsideration. #outro.
So what does this all mean? Brown-Forman's story right now is a powerful reminder, isn't it? Even when you have brands that are household names, a history stretching back generations, deep competitive advantages, no company operates in a bubble. That tension between honoring a rich heritage and the need for really aggressive adaptation, especially when the economy gets shaky and consumer tastes are shifting so fast, that balance is what will truly define their future. For you, the listener, the question becomes more than just what's in the bottle. It's what's this company's recipe for resilience? How are they adapting their formula for success in a world that simply refuses to stand still? Unquote. We really encourage you to keep an eye on those key metrics we talked about. Watch that U.S. sales trend, track the margins, see how Woodford Reserve and the Jack and Coke RTD perform. Observing how a true giant like Brown-Forman navigates this really pivotal, challenging period, it's going to be fascinating, and you'll learn a lot. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive.